From the studios of KPCW, welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts upon it. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
Today, Chris and I will be speaking with Utah Division of Wildlife Resources Native Herpetology Coordinator Alyssa Hoekstra. Did you know that there are 5 different species of rattlesnakes that are native to Utah? Did you know that, Chris?
Yeah.
You did know that.
Well, I did research.
All right. For today. Each one of them plays an important role on our ecosystem, and we'll be talking to Alyssa about these fascinating creatures.
Yes.
And then in the second part of the show, we're joined by Walt Meyer. Meyer is a senior research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center, and he'll be coming on to talk about the current state of Arctic sea ice. Now in March, this isn't great news, but in March, Arctic sea ice extent was at its lowest ever recorded for that month, measuring 6% below the long-term average.
Right. And if we have some time at the end of the show, a couple of news items, some good news with respect to wolves in the state of Oregon, and some not so good news with respect to microplastics in Antarctica. Yes. It's This Green Earth.
We have Utah Division of Wildlife Resources Native Herpetology Coordinator Alyssa Hoekstra. Welcome, Alyssa.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, we are thrilled to have you here, even though I have, as you described it when we were talking earlier, a good fear, I guess, of snakes, a natural fear. But I'm interested, first of all, in you, and then we'll get into these fascinating creatures. But what brought you to herpetology? Can you define what herpetology is and what led you in that direction?
So herpetology is the study of reptiles and amphibians. And I guess as a young child, I was always interested in animals and wanted to go into the study of animals. I just thought maybe at first it'd be fish. But then when I got to college, my vertebrate biodiversity professor, he was really awesome teacher. He always gave some really great fieldwork examples and very passionate about the topic. And I looked into what other classes he taught, and it was herpetology. So I decided to take that class. And I don't know, I just, something about those species. I like an ectotherm or cold-blooded animal because they're so vulnerable to their environment that it just really fascinated me, and I wanted to continue learning more and more about them.
Interesting. And so you are now based out of Utah, and we have 5 different species of rattlesnakes, but how many different species of snakes overall do we have here in our state? Do you know?
If you like include subspecies count, it'd probably be around 29.
Okay.
Wow.
And so 5 of them are rattlesnakes, and snakes in general are great for the environment, right? So let's first of all give maybe an overarching account of what snakes can do for a particular ecosystem.
So they're considered apex predators. So they tend to eat, you know, a lot of insects, so like smaller species. Or certain species of snakes will focus on eating like insects or, you know, other reptiles. Rattlesnakes are specialists, so typically because they can sense heat in their environment through their pits that they have in the front of their face or head, I should say, they usually go for warm-blooded animals, so rodents, birds, and with that, rodents, usually that helps control diseases for human populations. And that's why a lot of times if you have a rodent issue around your house, you'll typically find snakes around your house, and some species may try to go into your house, like rat snakes like to do that. But
why is that? Why would they want?
Because the rodents are going to be in your house.
So it's not a function of them wanting to seek warmth or something. They see coming into the house as a potential source of food.
Yeah, they can smell. They can do scent trailing for rodents or other sources of food, and so they'll follow that and track their scent. And if it leads into a house, they can find a crack in your wall or outside your house in the foundation and try to work their way into following the source of that smell, which would be a rodent. So as long as you secure your house, usually from like holes where they can get into. Usually that can keep them out. But, you know, you typically find that in, you know, areas where you'll have like rat snakes, which around Park City, you're not going to find them
okay,
here.
Okay, they're not in Park City or Summit County area?
They're more east of here.
East of here.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's rat snakes. All right.
But the rattlesnakes, so there's five different species of rattlesnakes. Can you talk us through the different species and what kind of differentiates each of them? What attributes do they have?
So we have five, and we do have subspecies of them. So there's the western rattlesnake, which is going to be found statewide. But we have two subspecies. So we have the great basin rattlesnake, and then we have the midget faded rattlesnake. Both are considered western rattlesnakes. The great basin rattlesnake is the most abundant that you're going to encounter, especially around here and then the western part of the state. They get about 4 feet in size, so they're fairly larger rattlesnake species that we have here. They have little spots going down their back that could help identify them, but then also midget faded, they're a little bit smaller. They're barely touched 3 feet, so average around 2 feet, and those are going to be found on the western side of the state, and those are also considered western rattlesnakes, but they're smaller. They do have the spotting as well. They're usually like sandy beige in color, both subspecies are. So those ones will be the ones you're going to encounter the most in Utah. And then we have ones that are located more southernly. So like Washington County, you'll get the sidewinder. And they're also like a sandier color. They like the Mojave Desert ecosystem. And so they'll have two little, like they call them horns on their head, above their eyes, and they are under 2 feet or roughly around 2 feet. So they're a bit smaller as well. But again, you're only going to find them in that southwest corner of the state. They do love to burrow into sand, and then hence their name, sidewinders. They have that very characteristic sidewinding movement when they do see. And if you're lucky, I know some people may not find themselves lucky if they were to find one or encounter one, but if you're lucky and you see that movement and pattern in the sand, it's a great sight and fascinating sight to see, I think. And then we also have around that area the Mojave rattlesnake as well. So there's that one. Again, there, a lot of our rattlesnake species kind of look the same. It's just maybe about geographically where you're located.
Right.
So they kind of have that sandy and spotting coloring. And they're also around 4 feet in size as well. So,
but
they're
here in Summit County, what, as far as rattlers go, what might we see here in Summit County's landscape, and where?
What type
of landscape would you see rattlers here?
So you're most likely to encounter the great basin rattlesnake.
Okay.
They really like, especially this time of year, you're probably going to find them in high elevation areas with rocky areas because that's where they like to den, in sloping rocky areas. So right now it's a little too cold overnight for them to be moving around to their active season home range. So they might though pop out around their den and bask for a bit and then go back underground during the cool temperatures.
So on a day like today, they might be basking?
It's possible. If it gets warm enough and they're stirring in their in their den, they could come out and pop out. It's springtime, so you know, they might come out a little bit to do that. But again, they're going to be around rocky areas, most likely not near trails, but if it's a trail that has a rocky slope, it's a possibility that you might see one basking on a rock.
Okay.
So this is a good time to be speaking about this because they do a type of hibernation, right? Like brumation is what they call it for snakes. And they have this kind of dormant state, right? They're not very active. But now as the weather starts to warm, this is a hot topic because they're starting to come out and we're starting to see them more. And so when you go into these different areas, like you said, the only time I've ever seen one is kind of sunning itself on a rock. But they're not aggressive creatures, correct?
Yeah, I wouldn't classify them as aggressive. They don't always warn you, so people assume that they have a rattle, so they're going to rattle at you, let them know that they're there, but that doesn't always happen. Sometimes they're under a rock even, and they might be buzzing at you. So there are some that will rattle at you, and then others that just try to be ignored by you and don't try to call attention to themselves by rattling. I don't think they're conscious of that, but it is definitely, you know, has been something that has happened with selection. Humans have accidentally selected for rattlesnakes that don't rattle, especially in areas where there's a lot more humans along with rattlesnakes. And so what happens when people hear a rattle, they might try to kill it. And so they're basically selecting for the ones that are making, you know, they're killing the ones making noise, and then it leaves behind ones that aren't making noise. And then that keeps passing on that genetic trait where maybe they're not going to rattle at you anymore.
Oh, interesting.
So you'll find populations where they don't rattle at people, don't give a warning or anything like that.
Wow. Well, my one experience with a rattler here was at Red Butte Garden on a April or May day, walking up the trail. It was a small one, you know, relatively small, maybe 2 feet. So, and it rattled. I'd never heard one before, but it is a sound that is unlike anything else you would hear in nature. And I guess there's an intent there to make them stand out. And nothing will make you freeze quicker than that sound. Stop, look down, and my very next step was going to be possibly on top of that snake. So it actually did me a service by saying, I'm here, watch out, because the next step is that I'm going to possibly bite you. So it did me a great favor by announcing its presence, and then I stopped, and then it scurried off under a rock, nearby rock. But that was my experience about, and I hear there are rattlers in that Red Butte Garden. Some of the Red Butte Garden has that rocky terrain, and so you come across them there, correct?
Yeah, you can find them there. Just to point out, you responded correctly. If you hear that noise, look around first before you take another step, because you might end up stepping on the snake. So it's good to gain your bearings before and locate it before you move on and take another step.
Going down that safety train, tell us some of the things that we should know to keep ourselves particularly safe if we do encounter a rattler.
So first off, to avoid a negative encounter or interaction with a rattlesnake, always look where you're placing your hands, where you're placing your feet, because the most likely bites are typically hands and feet, just because that's closest to where maybe you are grabbing things or stepping. So you want to first do that. And then if you were to hear either a rattle or spot a rattlesnake along a trail or near a rocky area, you just want to maintain a safe distance from them, usually around 10 feet. They don't want to, you know, we talked about, they're not aggressive. They're not going to try to pursue you. What their defense is to sit there and wait. That's their whole ambush strategy for acquiring food. And that's also their defensive behavior. And so even when I've encountered snakes and I was close enough, they'll go maybe a couple feet and they'll coil and just wait there. And then if I just step away further away, they'll just wait and kind of measure, probably, you know, measuring like, what am I going to have to defend myself here or not? If you remain calm, give them that safe distance, they most likely are going to leave you alone.
We're speaking with Alyssa Hoekstra. She's the Native Herpetology Coordinator for the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. And of course, we're talking all things snakes, particularly rattlers, because this is spring and they're, as Claire alluded to, they're coming out of their winter dormancy or so, and they're the days like today, they may be coming out to bask and warm themselves up. They're cold-blooded, as you say, and slowly coming out of that dormancy and looking, and there's lots of potential food sources out there. Do they have any predators?
The smaller, like younger rattlesnakes or even smaller species, sometimes raptors will attack them or try to eat them. Usually the larger they get, the fewer predators they will have, but usually it's going to be those raptors.
As you say, they're basically apex predator, except for some of the raptors or such, hawks and such. Yeah.
And I should also mention there are king snakes, which are known for eating snakes, and that includes venomous species as well. So they'll usually go after, you know, if they see a smaller, a younger rattlesnake or even a smaller rattlesnake species, they can eat it.
They're bold.
Yeah.
Okay. They are they here in Summit County?
King snakes, no.
Okay.
They're not found here, but yeah, and milk snakes are also known for that, and they're found here, but milk snakes are a bit smaller than a king snake, so they'd have to get, you know, they'd probably eat a really small, like a neonate maybe, which is what you call like a really young rattlesnake, maybe a year old, something like that.
How many little ones, little pup snakes are typically raised in a typical brood?
With rattlesnakes, it can vary by species and their size. Some can, and they, I should probably say, I think most people think of reptiles as being egg layers.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are, but rattlesnakes are live birthers, which means that the females will brood them in her body. And that's why you'll see rookery areas, they call them, where they'll kind of aggregate around rocky areas, usually fairly close to where they den sometimes. And that kind of protects them from predators because they're very vulnerable at that time.
Yeah.
They're going to be gaining weight and they can't move as much anymore. So they want to be near a rock where they can kind of slide under there and avoid any predation, but then they can also bask and warm up their bodies. So those females, some larger individuals can usually produce a dozen or so.
Okay. Are they giving birth around now?
No, it wouldn't be now. Right now they would be starting to develop inside. So rattlesnakes, going back when they mate, they usually will mate either in the springtime or the fall preceding the previous year. And then they'll be fertilized inside their body. And then they'll, if it's in the fall, they'll hibernate. And then when they come out of hibernation, the weather, the raising their body temperature will trigger their physiology to start developing those embryos. Because they'll freeze when they're, like, they'll kind of stop developing during hibernation because their body temperatures are too low to even have that process go on. And so, yeah, so they'll develop throughout the whole summer, and then in the fall is when they'll typically birth.
So,
like August and September usually is the high points when you'll see some younger rattlesnakes.
Okay.
What does the mating look like? I shouldn't say it that way. You don't have to draw me a picture of what it looks like, but what is that process? What's a snake mating system like? You know what I'm trying to say.
It's really funny because I did actually, when I worked with rattlesnakes out east, I worked with timber rattlesnakes, I did get to see mating behavior, and it's really, really fascinating to see because they vibrate their tails at each other. Like, it's kind of like a little shaking, like, vibration. Uh-huh. And then they'll try to wrap themselves around each other, especially their tails, and it's internal fertilization, so they need to get very close in contact for the males to be able to fertilize and mate with the females.
And the female doesn't kill the male at the end of it, like sometimes happens. Is that where you're going?
That's not where I was going, but
no, they don't bite their heads off or anything
like
that.
Okay.
No, it's a very mutual interaction.
Going back to rocky settings, so we're not going to see a rattler again up in a forested area. You know, that type of wooded area. It's more of woods with rocky outcrops or so, like near Quarry Mountain, literally. It has a lot of rocky sides. Now I'm thinking about dogs. This is another reason why we have to be maybe mindful of those dogs who like to explore and are very curious about, hey, what's under this rock or that rock? There could be something very detrimental to them if so. So for all our pups out there, be careful about them exploring in rocky settings.
You do want to make sure they're on a leash.
That's not happening
here.
It's Park City.
I understand.
Forget that.
But there is, then you have to kind of accept that risk that dogs are very, they follow their noses and they're going to find like that funky smell that that are very specific to some snake species, and they're going to follow their nose to it, and they might have a negative encounter. There are dog aversion training classes that seem to be very effective.
Yes,
so there is that possibility where if you are very resistant to leashing them, then maybe that would be the best route to go.
That's a great idea, and my friend took one, and she said it was very effective because they actually at one point exposed the dogs to an actual rattler, you know, in a cage or so, to hear the rattler and be told, you know, stay away. So there are services like that. I don't know, but you can do a search on that and find that.
If you Google, like, UWDWR, rattlesnake aversion training, you'll see on our website we have a couple businesses listed that you can contact for that.
She lives out in the Jordanelle area, Hideout area, and that's where the lots of rocky settings, dry, warm summer, and that she's come across quite a number of snakes in that area.
And just going back to, you know, yes, they typically are found in rocky areas, but there's also connectivity of habitat, and so they could be found possibly moving through wooded areas, in resting in those areas between habitats and stuff like that where they're going, even food resources. So I just wanted to warn people that it is possible they can encounter them between those sites too.
In the last few minutes, I know all about rattlers. What other snakes are here in Summit County that we might have come across, and are any of them also poisonous or might snap at us?
None are, other than rattlesnakes, that's the only venomous species we have here, so you're not going to find any others.
Okay.
So just the Great Basin rattlesnake, or even the midget faded, if you go further east, you'll find up this latitude. But you'll find, like, rubber boas, they're...
What?
Rubber boa.
Oh, rubber.
And they look kind of rubbery, that's probably how they got their name. They're kind of, they're fossorial, so they burrow underground. So fossorial is the term, so they'll go underground. So a lot of times you don't always see them around, but they're kind of a brownish, grayish color. And, once you see it, you're like, oh, it kind of looks like rubber. So that's probably how it got its name.
Wow.
Yeah.
Any in, wetlands? I've seen snakes from a distance in wetland settings. What are they?
That would be a garter snake, most likely.
So that's just a garter. Mm-hmm. Okay. A garter.
Is it true that every snake can swim?
That is correct, and rattlesnakes are very good at swimming, so don't rule them out with water.
Oh.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
They're very efficient. Not to go to other regions of the nation, but, you know, you have the eastern diamondback rattlesnake in Florida. They have barrier islands, and they'll swim out to those from the shores to those barrier islands. So, yeah, they're very efficient swimmers.
Are you seeing, with respect to a warming world, that different species are starting to migrate, say, north, or others or migrating in different directions or locations?
There's prediction models to show that they might be starting that they'll most likely start moving more north.
They still need the right habitat. Mm-hmm. It could, you know, just because it's a warmer world doesn't mean that, like you say, the sidewinder requires a desert-like setting. So it requires a couple of components for them to say, I can hang out here a little farther north. But there's some models that suggest that's a possibility.
Yeah, and there's some, you know, snakes, like you mentioned, the sidewinder, they're considered habitat specialists, whereas then there's habitat generalists like the garter snake, gopher snakes, milk snakes. They're generalists, so you can find them in a lot of different habitats. So they're most likely to be more adaptable to those warming temperatures. Elevation, too, the higher elevation species, too, can also have a negative impact because they might have to keep moving up more up on elevation and run out of room.
So last minute, so in summary, the majority of snakes that are here in Summit County, non-rattlers, are quote-unquote harmless. They're not out to get us. They're not aggressive. Even rattlers, as you say, are not aggressive. They're more defensive in nature. But we need to be mindful of them. And where can people go to get a nice visuals of them so they can have besides going out, I guess, and buy a book about rattlesnakes, does the DWR have a website that shows photos of them?
We have the field guide, it's called.
Okay.
And you can go on there, and it has a few species, like other taxa groups. Like, you know, you'll see fish on there and birds and stuff like that as well. So
is there any apps that I can, like some that where you take a photo of it and then have it, have an app look it up and then identify it?
Yes, iNaturalist is a really good source for that. Yeah, and people will tell you what species it is, and sometimes they'll have arguments about it, but that's helpful.
I would
recommend obscuring your GPS coordinates, just because some species are very sensitive to collection, and it would be good to obscure them so people don't target those areas.
So on iNaturalist, you have that option of obscuring its GPS, its location.
Mm-hmm.
Good point, because it was one of my questions. Like, if I come across a rattler, people come across a rattler, of course, the next thing you know, they're on next door telling everybody that they were out hiking at such and such a location and came across a snake. Mostly, again, dog owners or so who are out walking. But you would prefer that they not give specific location, just be mindful there are rattlers here, you know, on the northern side of the Jordanelle or something like that.
Yes, because it could have been a snake in movement. So
yeah,
just because you see it that one day doesn't mean it'll be there the next day or even in the future. But also I should add, we have a Herps of Utah project on iNaturalist that if you join, you can choose to share your coordinates with the admin, which I'm one of the admins, so I can actually see the obscured GPS coordinates, but it also protects that data, but gives us the data we need to know the distribution and the state of specific species that we're concerned about.
Wow, great. Citizen scientist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so valuable, so beneficial out there doing, assisting you with your work.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, I am growing fonder and fonder of snakes as we talk.
You lied, totally lied.
I'm a fan of garter snakes because I know they cannot harm me. No, I am really appreciative of you, Alyssa, and anyone out there that is studying herpetology. Not for all of us, not for the faint of heart. But
snakes do matter.
We understand that they are a really important part of our ecosystem, and that just like anything else, humans are probably a little bit more predatory or scarier or can have more detriments to them than they can actually impose upon us. So we appreciate you coming on here today. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Alyssa.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And joining us was Walt Meyer. He is senior scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center out of Boulder, Colorado. And Walt comes on periodically to talk about how things are going with respect to ice, sea ice, in both the Arctic and maybe the Antarctic, too. But Walt, thanks, as always, for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Nice to be talking with you again.
Yes, great to hear from you. Last time we spoke, I believe it was back in the fall, let's say September or so, and when Arctic sea ice is at its minimum, and over the winter, it expands. Let's start there. How did things go between September and, say, March of this year, this past year?
Yeah. Well, it was a fairly, I guess I'd say in some sense, a fairly uneventful season, but uneventful by recent standards in a sense. you know, the growth was kind of, somewhat slow, but again, that's kind of normal. The Hudson Bay was really quite extreme. It froze up very late, well into December. We had open water in Hudson Bay, whereas normally by November it's starting to freeze up and pretty much ice covered by December. So that was our kind of one extreme area. Elsewhere, it was fairly normal. But it was slow as we got towards the maximum in March. That's like you talked about, you know, that's when the spring starts coming, the sun starts rising, and the ice starts melting. And it didn't grow out as far as it normally does. That's been pretty standard in recent years, but it was actually a record low maximum. It's the least amount of ice covered at its maximum in our 47-year record going back to 1979. So it ended up being a new record. which again isn't too surprising given the conditions where we're at with the long-term declining trends. But it's always something I think worth noting, at least just as a marker of how conditions have changed in the Arctic.
Well, yeah, because it says here that the previous record low in March was set in 2017. So is it safe to say that, say, the top five lowest extents have been between 2017 and 2025, or say within the past 10 years?
There's been some that have been maybe in the last 15 years, but it's certainly in the recent years and then the more recent part of the record, the more recent, at least third of the record. And so, yeah, conditions are much more inclined or capable of setting new records and being very low because conditions are warmer, the ice is thinner, and it's just not growing as fast or as far as it used to. Just looking, I mean, basically our top five have been since 2015, so in the last 10 years, yeah.
Okay, now the usual suspects are warm air, warm water, maybe water movement, let's say storms may have an impact on ice growth, ice extent. What was going on this year that might have stood out?
Well, we had, like I said, Hudson Bay froze up really late. Now, it did freeze up completely, so it, in some sense, it didn't affect the record low maximum, but there was a lot of heat that was absorbed in Hudson Bay. And that's pretty indicative of around the Arctic. That's one of the things that slows the ice growth. We have less ice in the summertime when the sun is out and the ocean is much darker. It absorbs that energy. The ocean heats up. We see relatively high temperatures, not swimming weather, in the Arctic Ocean, but much warmer than we used to see as the ice opened up. And then that heat has to get lost. So it slows down the ice growth. And in some sense, that kind of delays things because and helps set up the record because it just doesn't, there's not enough winter to grow as far because it takes a while to catch up as the ocean loses its heat. Now, there are other things going on as well. There's variability in the ocean temperatures, and particularly on the Atlantic side, the Gulf Stream that flows up towards the north, up towards Scandinavia. Eventually, that goes into the Arctic, where it tends to sink down below the ice cover. So the ice is allowed to grow, but it's penetrating farther north, and that's preventing the ice from growing up north of Scandinavia in Russia. And so that's an area that we've seen that's persistently low and was low again this year in what we call the Barents Sea and the Kara Sea north of Scandinavia. And so that's certainly something that is playing a role. And then there's just the simple weather. Cyclones and storms can help the ice grow out or help it or prevent it from growing out. We didn't see anything really spectacular this year. But that always is playing a role in terms of exactly how far it reaches and how long it takes and when the maximum occurs.
Okay, so record low extent of ice, what about thickness of ice? Thickness or the thinness of the ice, any kind of records there?
We don't see any specific records. It's obviously been much thinner than it used to be. Two decades ago and earlier. So we are a much thinner, very different environment. The ice cover overall, much of the Arctic is at most about 2 meters, about 6 feet thick, whereas it used to be at least twice that thick over most of the Arctic. And so I don't think this year was, it takes us a little longer to get the data on the thickness and we have more uncertainty in the thickness. We can certainly see a change of, losing half of the thickness. That's huge and something we can easily tell that it's a significant loss, but exactly how thin it is, relative to like last year, in recent years, it's a little harder to tell. And so that's something we certainly look at. But one of the things in the wintertime, it still gets cold, and the ice does freeze, and it freezes faster early. And so if you are freezing up a little late, the thickness is not as affected quite as much. It's still a little bit thinner, but it's not quite as much as it would be. It's definitely, you know, on the low side and among the lower years this year, but exactly where it falls, it's still a little too early to say.
What does that change in monitoring look like as it declines, as it recedes? Are you finding a difference in how you're calculating or monitoring it?
Well, we have we do it mostly by satellite, and you know the satellite sensors have been consistent through the years. When we measure in the summertime, they are affected by the melt, and so there can be some effect from the surface melt and the melting of the ice. The sensors are not as good as picking it up, but one of the things we do is we look at not exactly how much is there precisely in terms of like a concentration. We look at the extent covered, and it's good at detecting, you know, if there's ice there or not. It's just not always good at detecting exactly how much there is in a given area. And so that's one of the reasons we what we call extent, which is an area covered by at least 15%. So we can tell it's more than 15%, but we can't always tell, is it 50%, is it 75%? That's a little more challenging, especially during the summertime. For thickness, we don't have a really great measurements during the summer, but in the winter we have what we call altimeters now that can measure the elevation of the ice. It sends down a signal and reflects it back up, and we measure the elevation based on how long it takes for that signal to bounce back up to the sensor. We've only had that data for about 15 years, so that's a little bit more limited, but we do have earlier data we can connect to from like submarines and field work that can give us some indication. And so we have at least a general sense, like I said, of being able to say, yeah, it's about half as thick as it was back in the 1990s and before, but it's a little more challenging to give kind of precise numbers, especially in a year-to-year variability.
And once you accumulate all this data and you go over it, what is it that we are hoping to understand, and what are actions that are being taken as a result?
Yeah, so you know, there's various reasons to monitor the ice. And one of the things, of course, is that there are communities living along the coastline, you know, in Alaska, for example, that rely on understanding the ice and how it changes, both, you know, kind of day to day, week to week, when they're planning things, as well as decade to decade as they, you know, have to adapt their ways. There's also, you know, interest in from national security implications, with the Defense Department, the Navy, having to understand where the ice is as they patrol in and around the ice or under the ice with submarines. But it also, you know, has implications, obviously, for climate and climate change. It's an important indicator of climate change because, you know, the ice is relatively thin. It's quite sensitive to warming, and we see the signal of the warming in the changing ice cover. It also gives us an indication of how fast things are changing and how we might expect things to change in the future. We use models as well for that because we don't have data from the future. We don't have a time machine, but the models are like a time machine. They can, you know, they can track the ice and see how it evolves under changing conditions in the future, under greenhouse gas emissions that are increasing and temperatures that are increasing. And we're seeing, you know, we're on a trajectory towards, at least during the summertime, essentially ice-free conditions in the Arctic Ocean, essentially a blue Arctic Ocean. When that happens is of interest. You know, how sensitive is it? How much is it going to change? How fast is it going to change? When are we going to reach conditions, you know, ice-free conditions? At what levels of greenhouse gas emissions are we going to reach those, and can we prevent that from happening? Because that's, you know, we're already in a different Arctic environment without a doubt, but it's going to be an even more extreme Arctic environment as we continue to lose the ice.
Yeah, and it almost acts like a container or a freezer for all of this organic matter. And then when it thaws, you had alluded to, it's releasing these harmful greenhouse gases instead of keeping them contained.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the oceans are a sink for greenhouse gases, and as the ice disappears, there can be more taken up. There's other implications in terms of the loss of the ice, in terms of keeping, like you said, it's like a freezer. It keeps the Earth cool with this cold core at the top of the pole and at the bottom in the Antarctic as well. And as the ice disappears, that means that freezer, it's like you're opening the freezer door, so it's becoming less efficient. And then, of course, it's affecting climate and weather systems outside of the Arctic as well. We have seen indications that, you know, weather patterns are becoming more extreme in the United States and Europe and Asia, in part due to the loss of the ice and the warming in the Arctic.
We're speaking with Walt Meyer. He's a senior scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center. Well, a listener texted a question with respect to salinity. They wanted to know if salinity plays a role in freeze and thaw conditions with more freshwater, per se, coming off of land-based ice entering into portions of the Arctic. Any relationship between salinity, changes in salinity, and freezing and thawing?
So there definitely is an effect. You know, the salinity salt in the ocean depresses the freezing point. You know, we think of freezing point as 32 degrees Fahrenheit. That's fresh water. When you add salt, depending on the salt levels, it decreases it. So in the Arctic Ocean, the ice forms, it really takes to about 28 degrees Fahrenheit for ice to form instead of 32. So it's got to be a little bit colder. There's another thing that's part of that is that the density profile, it changes. The density of fresh water, it gets less dense as it gets close to the freezing point. And so it freezes at the top. You know, anything that's approaching the freezing point basically rises to the surface. And so, like with lakes, it freezes at the surface and then freezes down. Mm-hmm. In the ocean with salinity, it actually sinks as it gets closer to the freezing point. Because of the salinity, it starts to sink. And so there's this kind of mixing that goes on, and you don't just freeze from the surface. You actually have to get what's called the mixed layer several meters down to the freezing point, down to 28 degrees. And so it's more challenging. It takes more energy to freeze. Now, as we lose as the ice is melting, that's now fresh water or largely fresh water. Mm-hmm. And so then you get this fresh water cap on top, which allows potentially more freezing. Mm-hmm. And it also stops this overturning. That actually is really important, kind of not right in the Arctic Ocean, but just outside of it, like along Greenland, because that's what's called the thermal halion circulation or Atlantic meridional oceanic circulation, which is basically helps drive the Gulf Stream. It allows the ice formation allows the adds salt, and then that salt is heavy, it sinks, and that kind of pulls up the warmer waters from the equator. And that's a big lever on the Earth's climate system. And there is some concern as more fresh water gets added from melting sea ice, as well as melting ice from Greenland, which is a big reservoir of fresh water,
right?
That is melting, that you will change that, and that could have really big implications for weather and climate, especially like in Europe and North America.
I wanted to circle back. We have a few more minutes. You talked about the importance that, say, the military is taking, takes notice of the conditions of sea ice for defense purposes, et cetera. But commercial interests are also getting more and more interested in the sea ice freeze and thaw cycles, because they see traveling their ships up above across the Arctic as a time saving element in traveling east west, west to east, etc. So they're becoming more and more interested in seeing if their ships can actually navigate ice free waters up there.
Yeah, there's a lot of interest in that, and thanks for mentioning that. Along the Northern Sea Route, along the coast of Russia, that has been used in the past. Russia controls that. They have often used icebreakers to help with that. The ice is thinner there, but in recent years, they haven't really even needed the icebreakers during a good chunk of the summer. Huh. But also the Western part, the North American part, is starting to open up. And so there's potential for being able to ship even like directly across the pole, which again would cut the distance from Europe to Asia tremendously. There's a lot of interest in that, in opening that up. It's still a challenge because, you know, the ice is still there. It's going to be there for a little while, and it's variable, but it's enticing people to go up there. There's even cruise ships that have gone up through the Northwest Passage through the Canadian archipelago, the Canadian Islands, that kind of famed Northwest Passage route. Cruise ships are starting to do that on a fairly regular basis. So yeah, things are changing a lot, and it does, yeah, has a lot of implications commercially.
All right, last minute or so. So we reached, the Arctic reached its extent on March 22nd, plus or minus. Since then, we're roughly a month later. How are things unfolding?
Well, it's interesting. We reached the maximum, started decreasing, but it's actually been fairly flat, which is really, in some ways, somewhat surprising. We see a lot of variability, so never that surprised, but it's been flat for about 3 weeks. And it may be that just, you know, because it was such a low maximum, it's farther north, and it just, you know, the conditions haven't been conducive to losing ice. Sooner or later, it's going to start losing ice as we head towards, you know, head through the spring and into the summer.
Right.
One quick thing is that it's not a real good indicator of what the summer minimum will be. Right. There's just not much correlation. It's going to really depend on what happens in like the summertime, particularly June and July, and how fast the ice gets lost and where the warm temperatures are. So we'll have to see what happens over the next few months.
All right. And that's why we will catch up with you in September when the ice, at least in the Arctic, reaches its minimum per se. Walt Meyer, senior scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center. Thank you so much, as always, for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
All right, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Walt.
Great show so far. We got a couple minutes left, and I thought I'd squeeze in this one news item. Some good news out of the state of Oregon with respect to wolves and wolf populations. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife last week issued its 2024 Gray Wolf Annual Report, announcing an increase in the wolf population for a new state total of 204 wolves, an increase of 15% over the previous records, roughly 178 wolves. Wolves in the eastern third of Oregon are currently not listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act, and they never will be, my comment. As part of the Northern Rockies population segment, federal protections were removed in 2011. So there has been some continued poaching incidents, et cetera, and it reduced the number of breeding pairs a few years ago. But they have recovered some, like we say, it's up to 204 wolves in the state of Oregon. The Oregon gray wolf population had flatlined at 178 wolves in 22 and 2023. In 2024, a total of 25 packs were documented, an increase from 22 in 2023. So that's some encouraging news. Obviously, if you actually like wolves and like having wolves around, that's great. There are those who would prefer that they not be around. So,
well, they're wonderful for an ecosystem, just like rattlesnakes.
Incredible. That's exactly right. And that's a nice segue, to thank our guests.
Exactly. We had Alyssa Hoekstra, who comes to us from the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources. She is the Native Herpetology Coordinator and spoke with us about the importance of rattlesnakes in our environment, also what you do when you encounter one.
Right.
And snakes in general, you know, even if they're a little slithering, creepy,
garter
can be.
Snakes.
They're a wonderful, wonderful part
yes.
of our world.
Don't you know, take a hoe to everyone. It's because it's a snake.
Exactly.
They're there for a reason.
Uh-huh. And they're more afraid of you than you are of them in the long run. So, yes.
But be mindful of your pups running around rocky areas.
Absolutely.
And sticking their muzzle in rocks or crevices where they perhaps shouldn't be.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And also Walt Meyer, who comes to us from the National Snow and Ice Data Center. He is a senior research scientist. Always good to have him on the show. Very smart cookie, that Walt, telling us about Arctic sea ice.
Yes, and the record lows that were recorded this past March. And hopefully we see some encouraging news when we talk to him in September.
Thank you for joining us today on This Green Earth. If you have any questions, comments, or guest ideas, please reach out to thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. You know we always love to hear from you. And, of course, you can listen wherever podcasts are shared. And we'll be back here same time next week for This Green
That's
Earth.
Right.
Yes, Chris?
You bet.
Back live in the studio.